This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The big three Detroit automakers flew back home in their private jets this week, stunned and bewildered. As the price of their stock dropped below that of a cup of coffee, they had hoped to wring out of Washington lawmakers enough money to keep them going. Money on the order of $25 billion, perhaps $50, $75, who knows. But it became embarrassingly clear to Congress that the automakers who came hat in hand had no plan in their pockets. This got us to thinking, why give all that money to people with no clear pathway to an electric car future? Why not give that money to people who not only have a plan, but they have the cars on the road or ones that are ready to go? For example, General Motors has made a lot about the fact that in 2010, they will have their Chevy Volt car on the road, which can get 40 miles on a charge. That is, of course, if the company is still around. But Tesla Motors already has a car that can get over 200 miles on a battery charge. And more than one company is selling a modification kit to Prius owners, which turns that car into a plug-in that they can charge overnight and get 100 miles per gallon today. Why don't we take some of those billions, give them to Tesla, for example, and have them ramp up production of their cars and bring down their hefty price per vehicle? Or why not bail out GM by just selling it to Tesla? Let them take over the company, turn those assembly lines into making greener plug-in cars that are made here in America with American auto workers. If small startup companies can engineer these technologies, let's show them the money. Or if big auto companies can't say, yes, I can, let's help out the other car companies like the Mini, which will have a new electric car on the road next year, getting 150 miles on a charge. Why don't we help them expand and build more factories in this country to make those cars or to take over the factories of the cars companies that go bankrupt? Mini took just 10 months to modify its car to get 150 miles. Detroit, well, you know the story. What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, if you'd like to get in on the conversation. If you're on Twitter, we have a new name. Yes, you can follow us at SciFry. That's Sci, S-C-I-F-R-I. You can also tweet us your questions. Just type the at sign followed by SciFry. Also on Second Life, we're also broadcasting into Second Life and taking your questions on Science Friday Island. Let me introduce my guest. Sherry Boschert is the Vice President of Plug-in America, author of Plug-in Hybrids, The Cars That Will Recharge America. She joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Hi there. Daniel Sperling is co-author of 2 Billion Cars Driving Toward Sustainability, a new book out in January. He's also a professor of engineering and environmental science and policy at the Davis campus at UC Davis and director of the Institute of Transportation Studies there. He joins us from Sacramento. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sperling.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Sherry, what do you think of this idea? Why not give the money to people like those other car companies, like Tesla, and let them become the car companies of the future? They say they can make this stuff.
Well, I think it's certainly worth considering. Since I was last on your show a year and a half ago, we've gone from one major car company, GM, saying that they're going to put a plug-in car on the road in the next few years, to 14 major car companies saying they're going to put plug-ins on the road. Not all of them for sale, some of them in test fleets. But that's a huge change. But we also have at least 11 small startup companies that are planning to put them on the road. So I think it's worth considering. The one thing that we in Plug-in America insist on is that if the government gives any bailout money to the major car companies, they have to come with strings attached. I mean, right now, the car companies are lobbying to change the rules on $25 billion that already has been approved by Congress in September to retool the industry to make clean plug-in cars. Well, they want to use that money just to plug the gaps, basically. No strings attached, business as usual. So even on the brink of bankruptcy, they're resisting change. It's really amazing.
We're actually going to have the chief technology officer of Tesla Motors, J.W. Straubel, come on later. We'll ask him that question, whether he could take over GM or they could be sold and build those plug-in cars there. What's your reaction, Dan?
Well, I generally agree. There's, first of all, the real point is there's great opportunity, lots of opportunity for improving our vehicles with electric drive vehicles, battery electric vehicles, plug-ins, fuel cell electric vehicles. All of these are far superior to what we have now. And most of the car companies, the CEOs themselves, will say that this is the future. And so the challenge really is how to get from where we are here to that future time where they are actually deploying a lot of this advanced technology, because most of these companies have pretty good experience with these technologies in the lab and demo mm-hmm. vehicles. So it's really a step of, I think the role for policy is how do we get them to get these vehicles out of the lab and onto the street?
But we've had them out for a while. Sherry, you drive an electric car, don't you?
Yeah, the idea that this technology is so new or not ready or still needs to be tested is, it doesn't fit my scenario. I have not driven with gasoline for 6 years and 69,000 miles in a Toyota RAV4 EV. We had thousands of electric cars on the road when state regulators required clean cars, and then they backed down in 2003. On the way to the studio this morning, I was privileged to stop by our local utility, PG&E, because they just took delivery of the first Mitsubishi iMiEV electric vehicle in this country.
What is it? What car? Describe that for us.
It's a little compact car. It's sort of a city car. Mm-hmm. It can go 80 miles in its current configuration. It's shaped sort of like a VW Beetle, that size maybe. Seats four. I rode in the back with another passenger when we took a spin around the block. Very comfortable. And it has fast charging. You can charge it on your regular outlet at home, or it can charge in half an hour instead of 5 hours on a fast charging. The difference is in Japan, the car companies and the utilities have all agreed on a standardized fast charging configuration. In this country, the Society of Automotive Engineers is working on standardizing. But Mitsubishi says they're willing to bring it over here and sell it in 2010. They just want to know exactly what we want.
And I mentioned the Mini people, the Mini Cooper people are owned by Volkswagen, right? And they're having this Mini E coming out. Next year, they're going to be leasing some of them. And this car gets 150 miles on a charge. It seems like, yeah. And it took them, I'm reading an article from the New York Times by Jerry Garrett, who said it just took them 10 months to bring this car to market.
The technology is not the issue. It's getting the car companies to do it that's the issue. History shows us that the automotive companies have never made an improvement that is environmental or cleaner unless regulators force them to. Mm-hmm. And now that they're behind the consumer demand, too. So you've got consumers and government coming on board saying, you got to do something here.
Mm-hmm. Dan, you said in an editorial in the New York Times, you argued for a $3.50 per gallon minimum on gasoline. Would that help pay for these things?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think what we need to be thinking about is not government picking winners. We've had enough mistakes in the past doing that. And so we need to put in place these policies that provide a framework for change that encourage these companies to move forward. And so the idea of a price floor, which actually in reality would be probably connected to the world oil price, because if you did a gasoline price floor, the local gasoline stations and companies could just manipulate their prices. So you'd link it to the world. But the concept is, yes, that if you have that price floor, now the companies like Tesla that make electric cars, the battery companies, the advanced biofuel companies, all of these companies are now going broke. They're the ones that are going out of business now, and we need to support them. And so if there's some certainty there that they know the price is going to stay at a certain level, not going to plummet, then it provides them an opportunity to compete better.
Let me bring in Tony Markle, a senior engineer at the Center for Transportation Technologies and Systems at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Markle.
Hello, how are you?
Tell us about your 2006 Toyota Prius Hybrid and what you did to it.
Sure. We've been working with the U.S. Department of Energy to research plug-in hybrid technology, and right now we're working with a 2006 Toyota Prius that has a larger battery pack in it. Basically, a battery pack from a company called HiMotion has provided us with a large lithium-ion battery pack to mm-hmm. allow that vehicle to be a plug-in hybrid vehicle.
And so you plug it in at night and charge it up?
We sure do.
And how many miles a gallon do you get?
Right now, when you're in the charge depleting mode, when you've got lots of energy in that battery pack, you are operating at somewhere around 85 to 100 miles a gallon. And then after that battery pack's depleted, you're back to about 50 miles a gallon like a normal Prius.
So you can run it totally on the battery for a while?
You have a mixture, mostly battery. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Mostly battery and a little bit of engine during that charge depleting mode.
So when Chevy says its Volt's going to get 40 miles on the charge, you've already got that.
It's not quite the same as what they're working with, mm-hmm. certainly.
Can anybody do this modification to their Prius?
Yeah, this is actually a product that is available right now from that company. Several companies out there have done things like this. It's not a perfect implementation, but it's certainly one step closer to getting us reducing how much oil we use.
What about using the batteries in long-haul trucks? Would that make sense?
That would definitely be a challenge to use batteries, at least for primary propulsion, but we can certainly use batteries in those vehicles to implement hybridization, where we're using the variation in the driving profile to gain some efficiency.
So when and I'll ask all three of you this, so when T. Boone Pickens says we've got to have natural gas to do those 18-wheelers, we really don't need to have that natural gas to do those drive those 18-wheelers.
Well, no, this is Sherry, and really for long-distance freight shipment, we should be thinking of electric rail and rebuilding our rail system. I mean, T. Boone backed off. Originally, he was campaigning in the Pickens plan, and here in California on one of our state ballot initiatives, he was talking cars. And now he's saying, oh, I really just meant trucks. It's because people saw through his smokescreen and saw that it doesn't make sense. On the Plug in America website, we have posted studies from Argonne National Laboratory and the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy showing that if you compare, you know, natural gas, compressed natural gas vehicles to electric vehicles are twice as efficient. So, you know, we need to look at the big picture here if you look at the well-to-wheel scenario.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more. I want all my guests to hang on, Sherry Boschert, Daniel Sperling, and Tony Markle. And your questions, 1-800-989-8255, talking about plug-in cars, future of electronic cars, and how to get them on the road. Why wait for Detroit? We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the future of plug-in cars and how you can beef up the batteries of your hybrid plug-in and plug it into the grid if you'd like to, with my guests, Sherry Boschert, author of Plug-in Hybrids, The Cars That Will Recharge America, Daniel Sperling, co-author of 2 Billion Cars Driving Toward Sustainability, Tony Markle, senior engineer at the Center for Transportation Technologies and Systems at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. And just a quick correction on my own part. I said that the Mini was owned by Volkswagen is owned by BMW. So I didn't want to make sure I corrected that. Let's go to the phone because we have lots of people with questions about this. Let's go to Jesse in Hartford. Hi, Jesse.
How are you?
Hi there.
Good, good. I think this is a fantastic idea. I'm a big supporter. I just want to play devil's advocate for a second. Maybe your experts can tell us what's going to happen, you know, 10, 20 million people plug their cars in at night. What's going to happen to the grid?
Are we going to melt the grid, Sherry?
That's my question.
Yeah. Good
well,
question.
It's an important question, and the Department of Energy looked at that in a 2007 study that, again, is on the Plug in America website. And if we magically created plug-in hybrids for everyone tomorrow, the existing capacity in the U.S. electrical grid at night, which is when people plug in, that's what's convenient. You go home, you plug in your car, you go to sleep, you wake up, and it's charged. The existing capacity could already charge 73% of every car, truck, van, and SUV in America in their commutes to and from work. That's over 170 million cars, and it takes a long time to get that many cars on the road. So let's get them on the road and start planning for a future of greater energy efficiency and more renewables in the grid, but let's get the cars now.
Dan Sperling?
Well, in theory, that's correct, that if you charge the vehicles off-peak, there's tremendous capacity for them. The challenge we have is to make sure people do charge off-peak, and there's going to be a tendency from people to charge, you know, during the day. And there's going to be, you know, you drive somewhere, you like your electric vehicle, your plug-in hybrid vehicle, you want to use electricity. So there's going to be a tendency to want to plug in. There's going to be a tendency, the Walmarts or Costcos and employers are going to want to provide this as a fringe benefit to their customers and their drivers to provide that during the day, during peak times in the afternoon. And so what we need to do is come up with, you know, pricing and other strategies to encourage people to charge off peak, because if they charge on peak, then we lose much of the advantage.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Dan on that for sure. I mean, here in California, anyone with an electric car can have time of use metering. And I do that also because I have solar panels on my home. So during the day, I'm feeding electricity to the utility at a premium, and at night, I charge for about a fifth of that cost. So those price points are very important.
Tony, how do you feel about it?
Oh, you know, I think the best thing we can do is provide the infrastructure so that folks can recharge those vehicles. Our best opportunity for displacing fuel is to be charging and charging those vehicles with electricity. And with just a tiny bit of control in the system, we can charge those vehicles throughout the day without a whole lot of infringement on the utility's operations. Mm-hmm. And we looked at that with studies with a local utility, and also I know that other utilities have duplicated some of those work to see that even just a curtailment on a couple days of charging those vehicles during the middle of the day gets us to large displacements of petroleum with with little need for expansion of our grid resources.
Let's say you park at Walmart, which now has its flat roof covered with solar panels, and it uses that huge area of solar panels to trickle charge all those cars that are in the parking lot.
That's the ultimate goal, is to get to where we have renewable resources on the grid that are then feeding into these vehicles, and we get the best CO2 emissions reductions we can.
Mm-hmm. But even today, it's cleaner to drive on electricity than on gasoline, even with 52% coal in our grid. So there's no downside to start to get those cars on the road now.
Dan?
And the other dream for the future here is to connect the vehicles into the grid, into the household and into the grid, because if you can use all of this capacity and all of these vehicles and make it available to the utilities, they don't need to build more capacity at peak times. They can, at those few hours of the day when they need extra electricity, they can get it. And you can provide this, especially from the battery electric vehicles, but also the fuel cell electric vehicles, because they will have a tremendous amount of energy on board.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to go back to something Mr. Sperling said earlier, that, you know, it's not the role of government to pick winners. Well, I actually disagree. I think it is the role of our elected and appointed representatives to pick winners, and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are a perfect example. I mean, this is pie-in-the-sky dreaming that's been incentivized by the federal government and the California state government for years at the expense of plug-in vehicles. It's topsy-turvy. I mean, you know, hydrogen vehicles aren't going to be around for decades, if ever, to the average consumer. The technology is not ready. And plug-ins are. So what the encouraging thing is that some governments are catching on to this. I mean, the city of Portland and its utility, Portland Gas and Electric, and Exxon held a conference earlier this week, press conference, saying that they're collaborating to get the cars there. Nissan will put its first electric cars in Oregon, and they're building up the electric charging infrastructure. And yesterday in San Francisco, the mayors of San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose held a press conference saying they, too, want the Bay Area to be plug-in car central, and they will help to build up the infrastructure. So people are catching on to this.
Is the battery technology ripe enough? But we keep hearing, well, the batteries aren't good enough. We've heard that from Detroit for years. Yet we're seeing these cars with batteries. And your car, Sherry, has a battery that seems to be working well. Do we need new batteries, new battery technology? I'm not saying,
yes.
Of course, you don't want to stop it, but, of course, it can't hurt. Was that you, Tony?
That was Dan.
It was Dan.
I'm sorry, Dan. Go ahead.
Yeah, we definitely need better batteries. You know, I mean, I agree that the batteries are good enough for some applications right now, especially some of the plug-in hybrids where you have a small battery. But these batteries, these advanced batteries, first of all, the lithium-ion batteries, which everyone is looking to for all of these vehicles, they're not even commercial yet. They're not. They will be becoming available soon, but they're not. And the early costs of those are something like about $1,000 per kilowatt hour. And the Volt, for instance, has 15 kilowatt hours. So you're talking about a cost premium of $15,000. Now, that cost will come down over time, but, you know, we need better battery. We need, at least we need to get the lithium ion batteries out there, make them safe. There's, the reason that they're being delayed is there's some safety concerns about them, and learn how to manufacture them better, bring the cost down, get to scale economies. So we are not, the only way we can do battery electric vehicles right now in a way that's available to the mass market is if you have it in a smaller vehicle with a little less performance. And those are the kinds of vehicles you're seeing now, the Smart, the BMW Mini, the Nissan,
the
and the Mitsubishi are all smaller city car type vehicles.
But the prices Dan is talking about, you know, what we need is battery factories. We need, you know, a commitment from a major car company or a big order from a small company so that the battery manufacturers are guaranteed that it's worth their investment to produce that many batteries. I mean, the price will come down as we make more. There's a number of good chemistries out there that we've had good batteries. Heck, we could be doing it with lead acid batteries. Yes, it wouldn't go as far, but people are hungry for these cars. They're buying little golf carts to get off of gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you would think that if we actually did, you know, what we call a moonshot in comparison, that in 10 years we could come up with the right kind of batteries with all this. We pour money into the research on these sorts of things.
Well, sure. Batteries will continue to improve, you know, but
Tony?
They're already good enough.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, both Dan and Sherry are correct that, you know, we have battery technology that's available and ready to go. It's also very very promising that we've had so many developments and improvements in the battery technology. We're definitely on a road for improvement, and those costs are coming down. We're working on lots of technology that will bring those costs down. You know, as we go forward, one of the greatest things we can do to make sure that we have the industries growing and developing is strong, consistent energy policy and consistent prices. Mm-hmm. I think you were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
That will help certainly keep these industries alive. The battery manufacturers need that to be able to sustain themselves.
Here's a question from Ash Foran on coming in on SciFry Twitter. What about the environmental impact of having all these batteries, which typically expire? The batteries expire after a few years. Where would we put them all? I guess disposal.
There's actually discussion about using some of these batteries as secondary use. They're even after they're finished in their vehicle application, their vehicle life. There's secondary use for those, and we also have recycling industries that are set and ready to go to recycle lithium-ion battery technology.
Mm-hmm. Tony, I understand that you have to go.
Sure.
Thank you for taking time to be with us. Tony Markle, Senior Engineer at the Center for Transportation Technologies and Systems at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden. One question before you go, Tony. Anything new? Anything else you're going to do on your Prius? Soup it up at all?
Sure. It leads into what Dan was talking about being able to connect these vehicles to the renewables on the grid. We have the potential to sort of work electricity in both directions with something called vehicle-to-grid, where you can connect that energy storage to renewable resources that might be somewhat intermittent. So that's the next step with the vehicle, is working with using energy storage and intermittent resources together.
Thank you, Tony. Good luck to you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dan, did you want to jump in with something there?
Well, I would support reinforce that. I don't think the environmental concerns with the batteries are what many people would think. And that's partly because these batteries are big and heavy. You don't just take these batteries and throw them in the trash. You know, they have value. You know, they have value for a secondary market. They have value in some of the batteries and the materials. And so, you know, this is not something like from your laptop where you can just, you know, these are hundreds of pounds they weigh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking that you were talking about $15,000 batteries, and if you get a million people at $15,000 batteries, that's $15 billion, is it? Or my zeros right or wrong on that? That's the kind of money you could take from a bailout and give it to people to buy a battery-powered car.
Uh-huh.
Instead of giving it to the car companies, and you know, we keep hearing that the car companies, that $25 billion may not be enough. They may come back for $50 and $75. Or more. I mean, why not give it to the people to buy the cars?
Yes, and exactly right. And that's why I say, you know, why, let's not pick the winners. Let's provide incentives for for people to buy low-carbon vehicles, fuel-efficient vehicles, provide these incentives. You know, we're already starting. The recent Energy Act provides some incentives. But that's exactly right. Let's create the market for it. And, in fact, this would help all of the car companies. And it would support companies like Honda and Toyota and Nissan that are actually doing something and making good progress. It would support them as well.
Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, let's not pretend that all options are equal. I mean, the federal government lopsidedly gives way much more money to hydrogen fuel cell research than to plug-in vehicle and battery research. The state of California lopsidedly incentivizes car companies to put a handful of hydrogen fuel cell vehicles on the road so that they don't have to build plug-in cars. I mean, let's not pretend corn ethanol is as good as some other kind of ethanol environmentally. I mean, let's talk reality here.
Okay, this is where Sherry and I differ. We agree on the corn ethanol, and that is an example of government picking winners, and that's why it's a mistake. And, you know, what we need to be looking to in the future is somehow making our transportation system more efficient, lower oil use, less carbon. And to sit here now, I don't think anyone can predict or forecast what exactly is going to be the winner technology. And in fact, I would argue it's probably going to be a mix of a number of them. It's going to be a mix of biofuels. It's going to be a mix of electricity and hydrogen. In some places, electricity will be more dominant. In other places, the biofuels. In other places, the hydrogen. So that what we need to be doing is encouraging all of them. You know, this sectarian strife between, you know, the EV people that say hydrogen is the devil, as I heard at a recent conference, is just not productive and is just wrong.
We're talking
so
about
–
Sherry, let me just interrupt pay some of the bills. We're talking about the plug-in cars this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking Sherry, and go ahead and finish up, Sherry.
Just, you know, if we're going to play that game that all options are equal, then let's at least give equal funding to battery research and development and plug-in car research and development. Put it on a par with hydrogen. I would be happy with that.
Would you,
Dan? I support. Yes, I agree. We do need more. I agree we need more research in batteries, but I'd say we need more research for all of these options. We spend much less on our energy R&D than we did 20 years ago. It's, you know, and given that now is the time where we really understand that we need to move to a clean energy, a low carbon future, this is the time we should be investing.
Go ahead, Chair.
Yeah, just one last point. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk research, but really climate experts tell us we have 10 years to try and turn around what we're doing in terms of carbon emissions. If we have any hope of stopping global warming or avoiding the worst effects, we're not going to stop all of it. 10 years. Well, hydrogen's not going to be ready in that time frame. You know, I'm not saying it'll never be ready. I'm saying what can we do now? Right now, we can do plug-in cars.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Greg in Burlington, North Carolina. Hi, Greg.
Hi. A couple of quick comments and then a question. Speaking about the oil companies, it would be good if President Obama has a windfall profits tax on the oil companies and used it for alternative energy. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion is just let the oil companies bail out the automobile market since they're linked together. And I would like to see someone like Rush Holt, congressman from New Jersey, be either transportation secretary, secretary of energy, or EPA administrator. And my question is, I was reading the New York Times about Chile, where they have vast fields of lithium. They're like the Saudi Arabia of lithium. And I'd like to hear your comments from your guests.
Okay. I'm sure there must be underground fields of lithium, not waves of lithium growing. Sherry, you have any comment on that?
Yeah, actually, Plug in America gets that question commonly. And so we had a PhD candidate do a white paper for us on lithium supplies in the world. It's up on our website for people to see. And it's very detailed, actually. And his conclusion is there are adequate lithium supplies in the world for the foreseeable future for lithium-ion batteries. And, you know, like Dan and all of us say, battery technology will continue to improve. I mean, today's flavor of batteries is not necessarily tomorrow's, but it's certainly good enough to get us going on either lithium batteries, nickel metal hydride batteries, the Zebra batteries, lead batteries, you name it. Let's get going.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-999-8255 is a number. We're going to take a quick break in just a second. But TDMC, it's twittering, says, how do we convert our gas-powered cars into electrical vehicles? Can it be done today? Can you?
But it's expensive. I mean, it's time-consuming. And so if you paid someone to do it, you know, it'll cost you $15,000-$20,000. Mm-hmm. So we really need to get the major companies to do it because they have the economies of scale to make it much more efficient.
Unless you had one of the hybrids like a Prius, which can be done a lot cheaper than that.
Yeah, plug-in hybrid, that's a lot simpler. And there's at least six companies I know about that will do it for you. One of them is National High Motion, HY Motion, and they are operating now in five cities.
All right, let's take a break there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're actually going to talk to the Chief Technology Officer to talk about, can you take over General Motors? We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about electric vehicles, plug-in cars, the best way of developing them, with my guest, Sherry Boschert, who is Vice President of Plug-in America, author of Plug-in Hybrids, The Cars That Will Recharge America. Daniel Sperling, co-author of 2 Billion Cars, Driving Towards Sustainability. It's coming out in January. And my next guest has spent his share of time mulling over batteries and plugs. He's Chief Technology Officer at Tesla Motors, a startup company in Silicon Valley that is designing very sleek and sexy cars that run just on electricity. In fact, they have signed up behind the big three Detroit makers, hoping to get some of that bailout money for the auto industry, get some of it coming their way if it ever comes. But Tesla's CEO Elon Musk says he's optimistic, and the company is churning out 15 of their high-priced sports cars a week. That's about 100 of their roadsters are now navigating the highways. Maybe you've seen one. And joining me to talk about these roadsters and the company's vision for a plugged-in future is J.B. Straubel. He is the Chief Technology Officer at Tesla Motors in San Carlos, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here.
Give us a little thumbnail of how far can your roadsters go on one charge.
Well, in recent testing, we drove on the EPA test cycles to about 244 miles. And it's really the first production-certified electric vehicle that's broken the 200-mile barrier, so that's something we're pretty proud of.
Wow. Let me ask, and maybe you can answer a question from someone in Second Life, T.J. Asp, who writes, please make one concession to the engineering literate and tell me how many kilowatts does it take to run a typical car at 50 miles per hour, flat, dry road?
Well, it depends a lot on what kind of car it is. There's a big difference in the aerodynamics and the weight, but it can vary anywhere from, I would say, around 10 kilowatts up to maybe as much as 20 kilowatts for an SUV or a truck or something like that.
Now, how are you able to get such terrific, you know, mileage like that?
Well, a lot of that is in the battery pack. We're storing more energy on board the car than any other electric vehicle has done. Our battery pack is about 53 kilowatt hours, and you know, the Volt, the Chevy Volt, is around 15. So we just have a much, much bigger battery pack, along with a fairly efficient car, and together those can give you the very long driving range.
So you've optimized the battery to go for a long range versus power, or how do you change those dynamics?
Well, we have done that. Our focus has been on getting very long range and very high energy, and because it's a pure EV, we don't have any gasoline engine at all, no sort of fuel whatsoever. Energy density in the battery is a critical metric for us. Mm-hmm. But because the battery is so big, it actually has a lot of power along with it. We don't have to focus on extremely high power battery cells in order to get these, you know, very quick accelerations and good driving, just like another sports car.
Mm-hmm. Now, your car is very expensive for my price range. It's over $100,000.
Yeah, the base price is about $109,000. But if you look at comparable gasoline sports cars in the same performance class, surprisingly, that's actually very competitive with vehicles that accelerate in the same range and handle it the same way.
Mm-hmm. If you could mass market your car, and if I gave you the GM plants to work in and scale up, could you bring down the price of that car?
Absolutely, and that's what we're really spending most of our engineering time on now that the Roadster is done and shipping. We're in development right now on a pure electric sedan that'll be about half the price of that, and that's still in relatively small volumes compared to what many high production vehicles are built at, about 10,000 to 20,000 a year.
Wow. So with the price of GM stock like worth less than a cup of Starbucks, couldn't you get enough money together, or go into Congress and say, give us the money, part of that bailout money, we can take over these factories, we could put American workers back, and we could build these plug-in hybrids, or just battery cars that you make.
In fact, we have filed an application for part of the $25 billion in DOE loan guarantees, and $25 billion is just a huge amount of money. I think it gets lost how large that sum is. And Sherry mentioned at the beginning of your program, there's over 25 companies now that are experimenting or have announced electric vehicles in one way or the other. And I think what's critical is that money gets spread around to a broad group of people so that we're not just betting on one company to try and do this.
Mm-hmm.
That's $1 billion each to win all those 25 companies.
And now you're talking real money.
Absolutely.
And do you think that within 10 years, given the right amount of money and spread around, that we could have all the cars in America plug-in electric vehicles?
Well, I think all the cars would be a bit of a stretch in 10 years, but we can be well on our way to a significant fraction of the new vehicles sold. I think well over a quarter of new vehicles sold could easily be plug-in vehicles of one form or other within 10 years.
And what about the big, heavy trucks? I asked this question before, the T. Boone Pickens questions about him insisting that we have to have natural gas to run those.
Natural gas could be one solution for those. They'll be a bit tough to make electric just because of the fact that, they're in use for such a large fraction of time and there's really not a down period to recharge. Passenger cars, end up sitting idle for 22 to 23 hours per day, but large, long-haul trucks are in use a much larger fraction.
Mm-hmm. GM talks about its Volt coming out in 2010. What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's a great program. It's going a long way to really prove to people that this is not just some sort of niche fringe technology, and that large car companies are really diving into plug-in vehicles. I think it's going to face some stiff competition, though, from other plug-in vehicles. When and if Toyota launches a plug-in Prius, I think that will be a very difficult competitor for the Volt. And a lot of this depends on where the final price point of the Volt lands. I think there's some definitely it's tricky to know where that will be, whether it's $30,000 or $40,000 or higher.
Can
I add a touch of reality to this discussion? I've driven JB's car, and it's a fabulous, the Tesla. If I had the money, it is worth $109,000. But there's not many people that can afford it. And as we look to the future, if you think about the gasoline hybrid car, which is a much simpler version of what we're talking about, it doesn't take any electricity from the grid, much smaller battery, much cheaper premium. It's taken us 8 years to get to 2.5% of the national market, 2.5% with the gasoline hybrid. And when you go to a plug-in hybrid, you're adding more cost, it's more complex, and more difficulties. And so this is not something that's going to happen today or tomorrow. Nissan just announced that they anticipate or they hope to have 10% of their cars being battery electrics in 2020. And I think that's probably the upper level of what we can expect in that time frame. And so, we need to be thinking about, the economics unfortunately get in the way here. And we talked about how batteries are expensive. And so probably the kind of vehicle that's really going to be mass market in the next 10 years are these what we call blended plug-in hybrids, where they have small batteries that you do plug in that gives you very high fuel economy but do not have that all-electric range like the Volt. And that'll be cheaper.
That's certainly a possibility, and we would welcome that. But it is a new day in America. I mean, President-elect Obama has pledged to put 1 million plug-in hybrids on the road by 2015. We in Plug in America think that could happen by 2012 and get 10 million on the road by 2016. A lot of it depends on the will of the people and the will of the government to incentivize this, to help the economy get rolling and build green jobs, building clean cars. It's a new day.
Yeah, I think extrapolating how the change has progressed over the last 10 years won't be the best indicator of how it's going to look over the next 10.
I mean, I'm sitting here thinking it's 1961 and John F. Kennedy is talking about going to the moon, and he says, you know, maybe if we get this, I can project, who knows, maybe by 1969 we might be in its lunar outpost but not on the moon. They went ahead and they did it. I mean, they made a 10-year, JFK made a 10-year commitment, and people rolled up their sleeves. We brought along our educational community, our teachers and our kids, and had a whole, you know, educational process that went with this, and people did it. You don't think we can do that in 10 years with plug-in battery cars?
Well, you know, Ira, the reality is that we can make our we can get much, much greater improvements from our conventional technology. I've been a champion of electric drive vehicles for, you know, 20 years now. There's no one that's more enthusiastic than me. But if what we want is reductions in oil use, reductions in greenhouse gases, the kinds of things that we can do is take the gasoline and diesel technologies and make it a lot better. You know, California now has, for instance, a greenhouse gas standard that the automobile companies have been suing California, trying to block them. EPA under George Bush has blocked it as well. Fortunately, President-elect Obama says he will not block it any further. But if those standards are imposed, then the vehicles are going to get much more efficient. They're already, the fuel economy standards call for a 40% improvement for new cars by 2020. The California ones
pushed
that up.
Wait. I understand the politics that you're talking about. I'm talking about the demand from the public. The public wants these cars. Why can't we give them to them?
Cost.
Well, but you just heard the J.W. Straubel say, you know, if we could ramp up to the size of General Motors, and we could build all these cars. And we could bring the cost down also.
We can, and we will. But the reality is those vehicles will cost more, and some people will buy them. I own two hybrid cars. I've paid the premium to have them. You know, Sherry's bought her car. But they cost more. And, you know, we can provide incentives to people, but those incentives represent a lot of money. And are we as taxpayers, much?
Yeah, just to play devil's advocate here, you sound like you come from Detroit.
I come from California.
I know you do.
The car companies keep saying, we can't. And today more people are saying, yes, we can. And the way technology goes too, you know, sure, new technology is always more expensive. Think about cell phones. Anyone my age remembers when they used to be as big as a shoebox and they cost $1,000. Now they fit in the palm of your hand and they're practically giving them away free. Mm-hmm. We can accelerate that process. We can make this happen. People want these cars. And now we're going to have someone in the White House who's going to help us make this happen.
JB?
Yeah, just one comment on cost. I think what's critical is to really look at the total cost of ownership. If you focus entirely on the initial purchase price, sometimes I think we can make the wrong decisions here. Because what you do when you're buying a plug-in vehicle is you're really moving some of the price into the battery pack and into the vehicle, what you would have previously paid for fuel, because your energy bill for the lifetime of the car drops enormously. And there's some creative ways that can be spread around. And as long as you look, you know, intelligently at how that savings really plays out over the life of the car, it's much more competitive than it might seem.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about plug-in and electric cars this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Getting a question from Edueno in Second Life. Isn't the missing piece an open interstate grid? Do we need to do the grid over for this?
Well, you know, eventually there will need to be grid improvements whether we have plug-in cars or not. I mean, if we're going to put more renewable power into the grid, which we want to do, we need to upgrade transmission lines, et cetera. Yes, if we put millions and millions of plug-in cars out there. But to get started, no, we don't need anything but the cars. And while it takes time to roll those cars out, we can plan ahead. We can see what we need. We can put in what we need. And we can start converting all of those gas cars out there. Because even if we start producing new plug-in cars, there's all those polluting cars using Middle East oil that we could be converting as well.
We're going to take the last question. Michael from California. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, quickly.
I think all this talk on technology is missing what I think is a systemic problem, which is that the organizational structure of Detroit is a Hummer. And we need to retool it into a Prius. And there are concepts of community capitalism where we begin to think like capitalists. And if I had $27 billion, I wouldn't be looking to give it to the managers of the car companies. I would be looking to purchase the company and create a company where the people working for the company actually where we bring Jeffersonian democracy to corporate structures, and the people who work for Detroit end up owning the companies in the end and maybe partnering with companies like Tesla. Hmm. We use that bailout money to buy the company.
All right. Thanks for your opinions. We've just about run out of time for this discussion. Very interesting. We will pick it up later. Sherry Boschert is Vice President of Plug-in America, author of Plug-in Hybrids, the cars that will recharge America. Daniel Sperling, co-author of 2 Billion Cars, Driving Towards Sustainability. That's coming out in January. He's also professor of engineering and environmental science and policy at UC Davis. And J.B. Straubel, who is chief technical officer at Tesla Motors in San Carlos, California. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Ira.
Now it's our weekly pick of the week. Flora Lichtman is here for our pick of the week, our video pick of the week. What's on the video page today?
It's related, Ira. This week we're looking at the future of cars. So Charles Berquist, the director of Science Friday, and I went over to the Jacob Javits Center to the World Congress on Intelligent Transport Systems.
Boy, that's a pretty big mouthful.
Yeah.
Smart cars,
basically. Right. And one that caught our eye was this vehicle from Southwest Research Institute that does something very special.
It does something special. So you have this video. You and Charles went over there, and it's on our webpage at sciencefriday.com, and the video pick of the week.
Yes. And here's a hint. It doesn't require a driver. A car without a driver. You can see it driving itself, and it has some pretty neat tricks.
And this is a car that drove in New York City.
Yes. I mean, to be fair, they did block off 11th Avenue, so it's not like it was going through Times Square by itself, but it did drive on the streets of New York with just, you know, just car operating itself only.
Were there a lot of electric cars there at the convention?
We did not see any electric cars.
No electric cars, but there were different kinds of smart cars they were showing.
Yeah, there were smart cars. I mean, the point of the Congress was to look at this sort of automated technology, things like crash collision avoidance at intersections, new navigation tech routes and stuff like that.
So this is a Science Friday pick of the week at sciencefriday.com. The video, you will watch the new smart car. It has a surprise to it.
It's very smart.
Very smart. All right, Flora, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today. That's Science Friday's Pick of the Week, and that's about all the time we have for this hour of Science Friday. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Our intern is Molly Ashford. Josh Rogerson is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you have your comments or questions, you'd still like to use a pen or a pencil, our word processor. Our address is Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can see Flora's video pick of the week and also dozens of other videos from past weeks. We'd love to see your video. If you have a suggestion, you're making one, we'd like to feature it if we can. Also, we're podcasting and blogging and Twittering. SciFry is our new Twitter name, so you know how to reach us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.